From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. March Madness has yielded to April agitation, much the same as college basketball's antepenultimate and penultimate teams will fall away to the eventual winner. Ahead on Only a Game, a Final Four preview. Also, Chicagoans fret over possible changes to Wrigley Field when the Cubbies are sold, and a conversation with Liz Clark, author of One Hell of a Ride, How NASCAR Swept the Nation. Also ahead, a competition involving the recitation of numbers which reflect the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter.
Some people think memorizing pi is stupid, but I don't know, people can do what they want with their own brains and feel like rattling off 1,000 digits of pi like I expect to hear from somebody. Then that's fun to watch.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Today it will be lots of fun to see the team that's number one compete against another team that's number one. Though it may seem redundant when that game is done, another team that's number one will face a team that's designated number one. If addlepated, never fear the maze-like path. Pat Forty knows the story's math, which is why he temporarily puts aside his duties with ESPN.com and joins me now to talk college basketball. Hello, Pat.
Hello, Bill.
For the first time since seeding began in 1979, all four number one seeds, Kansas, UCLA, North Carolina, and Memphis, have made it to the last weekend of the NCAA men's tournament. Are you disappointed that a Cinderella-like Davidson wasn't able to cause bracket havoc, or does the unprecedented quartet of top teams thrill you?
You know, I do miss Davidson. I've missed him since the minute that shot didn't go in to end the regional finals. You know, they're a great story, great storyline. They would make this whole week a lot of fun. But the brute fact of the matter is that usually when those teams do get here by Saturday night, you're wishing they weren't, because the game that they're involved in tends to not be very good, very compelling, very close, very dramatic. And it's hard to see a way where the games will not be all of those things this time around with all four number one seeds. Four teams that haven't even had a losing streak this year, Bill. Nobody's lost more than one in a row. All of them have won at least 11 straight games. All of them won their conference championship. All of them won their conference tournament championship. I mean, this is an all-star cast.
The NBA requires players to wait a year after high school before joining the league. Commissioner David Stern allegedly wants to make it 2 years by 2009. Will these rules create more Final Fours like the current one?
It's possible. I think that would be a great rule change to get them at least 2 years in there, because as it is now, we're talking about players that basically have to pass 6 hours of class in the fall semester, and then if they choose never to go to class again or open a book again, they're fine, because there's no grade check before the NCAA tournament, you know, check on their academic standing, and it just makes a mockery of the proceedings. If you're going to keep these guys in school for 2 years, then probably you will see the power teams from the power leagues rising to the top and staying to the top. But I would welcome that change.
The first game tonight will pit UCLA against Memphis. UCLA showed that it belonged with a rout of Xavier in the West Final. Last time we talked to you, though, you said the Bruins were very good, but probably not great. Have you changed your mind?
A little bit, yeah. They proved a lot to me in the course of this tournament run. You know, they still had one, you know, fortunate escape against Texas A&M along the way, but it was a dominant game against Xavier at a time when they needed to show some dominance. There's still a bit of a two-man crew with Darren Collison and Kevin Love. The supporting cast is okay, not great. It would be nice if Josh Shipp made a shot every month or so to take the pressure off the top two guys, but they're a really good team, and it should be one heck of a game Saturday night for them.
Memphis has only one loss and one giant weakness, which is free throw shooting. Can the Tigers overcome that flaw and make it to the finals on Monday?
Yeah, at one point they were, I believe, 20 of 24 against Texas in the regional final at the free throw line. So at least for one game, they put that to bed, and at a great time, because then they haven't had to hear about that all week.
I mean, till now.
Yeah, till Bill Littlefield throws it at them. There you go. You know, I think that they are an excellent team with all the right pieces, and the way they're playing right now, it's kind of hard to even think that they have a weakness. But You also have to think it's going to be a close game against UCLA and probably a slow game, which is what UCLA prefers, and then that will really put the onus on them to step to the line and make free throws. We'll see if they can do it two games in a row.
The late game features North Carolina and Kansas. Tar Heel coach Roy Williams used to be known as the best coach without a title while he was at Kansas. Then in 2003, he moved to his alma mater, North Carolina, with whom he won a championship in 2005. And meanwhile, his successor, Bill Self, now holds the mantle of best coach to have never won. And 5 years later, Jayhawk fans still hate Williams for his alleged betrayal. Do you think things might be a little emotional in San Antonio when that game gets underway?
Oh, I think so. I talked to a guy this week who runs a T-shirt shop in Lawrence who said, this is the biggest game in the history of Kansas basketball. So he's putting the stakes pretty high. Talked to a number of Roy Williams friends who they're so uncomfortable about it that they're not even going to San Antonio. So how do you think Roy feels? This is a guy who's very sensitive, wants everybody to love him, has rabbit ears for criticism, and he's going to go in and hear all these fans of his old school booing him. Meanwhile, Bill Self gets one monkey off his back by getting to the Final Four, but then what stands in his way of a national title but the old Kansas coach? So the pressure redoubles itself upon him. There are a lot of intriguing storylines, and I'll be interested to see which coach is keeping his composure best as the ball game tips off.
Carolina has trounced every team it has faced in this tourney. Will that trend continue, or will Kansas fans have their revenge?
I think it's going to be a very, very close game. I think North Carolina is the better team. Not by much, though. Kansas needs to play much more loosely than it did against Davidson, and they should, because there was so much pressure on them, to get to the Final Four, and to beat a team that everybody figured was vastly inferior to it. So they should be able to play more loosely here, but I do believe Carolina is the better team. Ty Lawson getting up and down the floor, Tyler Hansbrough carrying them on. I think that they'll be there Monday night.
Pat, I didn't get a chance to see your brackets before the tournament began.
Goodness.
Thank goodness, he says. I assume they are a quivering mass of poorly prognosticated goo by this time, in which case they probably resemble mine. But I am going to ask for a finals prediction anyway. Who plays whom and who wins at the end?
Yeah, I think it's a North Carolina-UCLA final, which is as blue-bloody as it can get in college basketball. Five titles for the Tar Heels and 11 for the Bruins, and all that tradition and all those smug fans talking trash to each other on the Riverwalk here in San Antonio. UCLA is going to have the harder task, I think, getting there. They have to make sure the tempo is in their favor. If it gets out of their tempo and it's an up-and-down game, Memphis will steamroll them. But I'm looking for UCLA and North Carolina on Monday night, and then I'm looking for Roy Williams to win it all a second time and the Kansas fans to dislike him even more.
Pat Forte covers college basketball for ESPN.com. Pat, thanks a lot. Enjoy the games.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
The Chicago Cubs last won the World Series in 1908, and for the 100th straight spring, Second City spectators will wonder whether their beloved team can make it all the way. But they're also talking about the impending sale of the Cubs and Wrigley Field and the renaming and renovation that could change the historic ball yard forever. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo reports.
There we go. Stick it to Zell right there. Stick it to Zell. Come on.
Oh,
take it.
Yeah, baby.
No, take one out of here. Take one.
Oh, take from here. Okay.
Yeah.
I hate Zell.
Jerry Pritikin, the self-proclaimed bleacher preacher, is outside Wrigley Field greeting the opening day crowds and encouraging them to use stick pins on a human-sized voodoo doll. He says it's taken various forms over the years, but on this day, it represents billionaire Sam Zell.
Sam Zell is now the owner of the Tribune, and by osmosis, the owner of the Cubs until he sells it. He's trying to sell the naming rights to Wrigley Field. That's like selling the naming rights to the White House or the Grand Canyon or Mount Rushmore. Some things you just don't advertise with a name on it.
Actually, Wrigley Field is already an advertisement for chewing gum. Back in 1926, the ballpark was named after owner William Wrigley Jr., whose family also happened to own a gum company. In 1981, the Cubs and Wrigley Field were sold to the Tribune Media Corporation. But last April, the Tribune was purchased by Chicago real estate mogul Sam Zell for over $8 billion, and it was announced that Zell would sell the team and the ballpark. Zell wasn't available for comment for this story, but Tribune senior vice president in charge of the Cubs, Crane Kenny, thinks the impending sale has nothing to do with the massive debt the Tribune company has, which is estimated at over $10 billion. It's speculated that the group will sell for somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion. Kenny claims the sale will only help the Cubs become a better team.
It's not because Tribune's in debt. It's about being competitive in our game here. And so this in a lot of ways has nothing to do with whether Tribune is now has a substantial amount of debt. This is something that the game demands, and that's what we're doing here.
Wrigley Field and Boston's Fenway Park are the only surviving, authentic, old-time ballparks still standing from the 20th century. Blair Kamen, architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune, says Wrigley's current configuration came through a series of renovations over the years, but it'll be tricky to make more additions to the iconic stadium that sits about three stories high in the city's North Side neighborhood.
Anytime someone wants to put in new skyboxes and other revenue-generating features to a ballpark, they can mess with it and they can mess it up. Now, one should also say they could also improve it. Wrigley isn't perfect, but at Wrigley and at Fenway, less is more. In so many of the new baseball stadiums, there are restaurants and shops and massive concourses and club seats. They've been packed with so many things that, including swimming pools down in Arizona, that people practically forget they're there to watch a baseball game.
Stuart Shea is the author of Wrigley Field, the Unauthorized Biography. He says structural changes and a new name for the park may not wash with the fans.
I don't see anybody being able to sell the idea of taking the name of Wrigley Field off the stadium completely. It's not possible. People will still call it Wrigley Field. Here in Chicago, people still think of the White Sox ballpark as Comiskey, even though it's officially been called U.S. Cellular Field for several years.
Right now, the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority, owners of the field where the White Sox play, is making a pitch to buy the Cubs and Wrigley. Jason Rieger, one of five bloggers calling themselves Goat Riders of the Apocalypse, says he's not concerned that a new name will be tacked on to Wrigley's landmark-protected red and white sign at the park's entrance. But he is worried about disruptions, which could change the feel of its friendly confines.
There's just a massive amount of ad space available, the Jumbotron, constant commercials. But I don't need to be told when to make noise. They need that at other ballparks. They need to get the crowd excited. Wrigley Field has great fans. We always cheer at the right times. We don't need a Jumbotron for enthusiasm.
But Tribune architecture critic Kamen says changes may be needed if the Cubs are to win their first World Series since 1908.
The key really is, how can the Cubs and whoever owns Wrigley raise enough revenue to put a really good team on the field? You want them to end this nearly century-old drought and win the World Series. But you also don't want them to destroy Wrigley in the process. So this is really a fascinating question that involves balancing the cash register and the cathedral and trying to strike the right balance between those two. And that's what this debate is really all about.
For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Welcome to Wrigley Field. Opening day.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Andy Heatman, if that really is his name, was recently barred from the Merseyside Gym, where he'd been a member for 4 years. I was on the bike, doing part of my usual routine, when a member of the staff walked over and sniffed me, Mr. Heatman reported. The staff member was following up on complaints that Mr. Heatman sweated too much. Said Cheshire Lines gym owner Bill Martin, "We did everything humanly possible to avoid humiliating him, but we have standards, as well as any other gym has standards." The Total Fitness Gym at Switch Island has different standards. Officials there have welcomed Mr. Heatman and told him he's welcome to sweat just as much as he likes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, once more into the breach, undaunted, we delve into NASCAR. But first, if you look at the NBA standings, you'll see that the little numbers and letters indicating which teams have prevailed in their divisions and conferences and otherwise achieved spots in the postseason have begun to appear. The Denver Nuggets are still striving to be one of the 8 Western Conference teams included in the playoffs, though they have a record that would put them in 4th place if only they played in the East rather than the West. This week I asked Chris Dempsey, who covers the Nuggets for the Denver Post, whether this season that has seen the team bobbing above and below the line separating the playoff teams from the dross has been exciting or excruciating.
Well, you know, I think it's been skewed more toward excruciating. But, you know, expectations being what they are, I think that, you know, the fans, they're kind of excited, but they're a little bit frustrated. There's a lot of emotions going through them because they expected a team that would be on a little bit more solid footing right now.
Should Denver end up falling short of the playoffs, the Nuggets would get a higher pick in the NBA draft. They might even get the first pick, but Chris Dempsey doesn't think the team would be better off losing on the court for the sake of possibly winning in the lottery.
They view themselves as not only a playoff team, but a team that can make a run in the playoffs. They feel like they have all the pieces they need to be able to do that, so their expectations are to be in the playoffs and then to be a factor once they get in.
Whether it's the Nuggets, the Mavericks, the Rockets, or the Warriors who end up missing the postseason, some people will argue that the league's format for determining playoff teams should be re-examined, since the current system may eliminate a Western team with 50 wins while welcoming in an Eastern team, probably Atlanta, that falls short of 500. Chris Dempsey is not among those calling for the demolition of the present system.
I don't think so. I just think that what we're witnessing this year is just an unusual season. The amount of teams that have been able to win 50 games already and the teams that will win 50 games by the end of the season, it's something that we might never see again.
Joining me now to talk further about the way the NBA's postseason is shaping up is Kevin Hench of Fox Sports. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The aforementioned Denver Nuggets, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Golden State Warriors are competing for the last 2 spots in the Western Conference. Which 2 will make it?
Well, I think it's the Mavericks and the Nuggets that sneak in. I up until this past week when they laid a couple eggs in Texas, I thought the Warriors might make it, but it doesn't look good now.
At the top of the West standings are the New Orleans Hornets. The San Antonio Spurs are right there with them. The Lakers are not far behind. With 2 weeks left in the regular season, there are 6 teams still in the running for the conference's top spot. Which team will be there at the end?
I think it's going to be the Spurs. I know that's boring. I know that's not good radio. But they are, as ever, the team to beat heading into the playoffs, and I think they'll be the number 1 seed. Although this year, I'm not sure it really matters that much.
I really appreciate your concern for good radio. Let's try for some in the answer to this next question. The New Orleans Hornets have endured 2 years of home games in Oklahoma City, several years under the ownership of George Shinn. They are my candidate for feel good or feel great story of the year. How about you?
Well, they certainly are a feel great story, and Chris Paul is a legitimate MVP candidate, and I think it's too bad that the conventional wisdom seems to be cementing around Kobe Bryant, because I think arguably Chris Paul is more important to the Hornets, or as important to the Hornets, and David West has just been outstanding, and Tyson Chandler's been re-erected in New Orleans, and they are an absolutely feel-good story. Now, here comes the feel-bad part, Bill. I don't think they're deep enough to go very far in the playoffs. So,
That's okay. That's okay. One step at a time. The Phoenix Suns were ridiculed for acquiring Shaquille O'Neal from Miami.
I did some of that myself.
Yes, I did hear some ridicule coming from that quarter. Some felt that he would slow down the run-and-gun Suns. But the big saguaro seems to be flowering in the Arizona desert. Can Shaq help end the title drought?
Well, I picked the Suns to represent the Western Conference in the finals at the beginning of the season. I did waver when Shaq came on board and they started giving up 120 points every night for about 3 weeks. But they do seem to have improved around him, and particularly Amari Stoudemire, who's just played out of his mind in the last month. And I'm going to stick with the Suns as my Western Conference representative. Still a little bit of a long shot, given how well the Spurs are playing. But I think maybe the big Aristotle has one more treatise in him before he hangs them up.
When I turn to the East Coast, the only real question I have is, can anyone stop the streaking Atlanta Hawks?
Well, the Toronto Raptors had a chance to do it this week, but as per usual, nobody knows how to foul with a three-point lead and less than 5 seconds left in the game. So they let Mike Bibby shoot a game-tying three, and then the Hawks won in overtime. Yes, I think the Hawks have secured the right to be slaughtered by the Celtics in the first round.
Seriously, though the Hawks are surging and have some conference rivals worried about a potential first-round matchup, the Celtics are the team of the moment.
Well, the team of the next few moments, I think. They are playing so well and playing so hard, and they are so deep. You know, that was the big question at the beginning of the year. Did they have anything beyond the big three? And I think night in and night out, they prove, I mean, James Posey is a legitimate sixth man. He is a great defender, a great three-point shooter, and knows his role. Leon Poe has been playing fantastically for a month now, and he's just become a man down low, unstoppable off the bench. I'm a little concerned about the Sam Cassell experiment for the Celtics. I think that that could hurt them, actually, if he gets too many minutes in the playoffs. I think they played with more energy when Eddie House was getting those minutes. Rondo, of course, has been playing great lately. And I think even though the Cavaliers shape up as a challenge in the second round, I do think that the Celts and Pistons will have their predestined meeting in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Just in terms of basketball entertainment, let's talk about first-round matchups. In either conference, what would you like to see?
Well, I word of warning for the team that draws the Sixers in the first round, because that team goes out and plays hard every night. And if it's the Orlando Magic, I think that's one upset that wouldn't be that much of an upset. I think the Sixers, they rebound the ball well. They play tough defense. And Andre Iguodala is a star. And I don't think anybody wants any part of the Sixers in the first round of the playoffs. In the Western Conference, although I know I'm not unlike the conference itself, I'm a little all over the map here. I picked the Suns. In my brain, I think it's probably the Spurs, but I want to reserve the right to say I told you so if the Jazz make the finals.
You haven't left anybody out.
Well, I have egregiously perhaps left the Lakers out, because I think they peaked too soon, and I don't think that they're going to go to the finals. But I love what Jerry Sloan's doing with the Jazz, and I think Deron Williams, Carlos Boozer, Mehmet Okur, Kyle Korver, that is a tough team in the half court. And what if the playoffs have taught us anything for the last few decades, is that you've got to be able to score in the half court to win in the playoffs. And I really like what the Jazz do in the half court.
Kevin Hench is a columnist for FoxSports.com and the writer for the new movie The Hammer. Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
When Richard Petty, known to NASCAR fans as the King, won his first race in 1959, his father, Lee Petty, protested the result, contending that the official scorer had miscounted Richard's laps. The scorer agreed and awarded the victory to the second-place finisher, Lee Petty. Of such stories is One Hell of a Ride Made, subtitled How NASCAR Swept the Nation. One Hell of a Ride is Liz Clark's chronicle of the sport she's been covering for various newspapers and magazines for several years. Liz Clark is currently a sports writer for The Washington Post, and she joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington. Ms. Clark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. I'm thrilled to be here.
From the beginning, NASCAR has been a family business. Bill France began that business shortly after the Second World War. Describe for us the circumstances of the meeting Mr. France convened at the Streamline Hotel in Daytona to get things going.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was quite a display of power and guile. Stock car racing certainly existed before Bill France came along. It grew out of this wild moonshine running tradition in the South. And this very inventive, visionary promoter, Bill France, decided it was time that serious money be made from it.
And long as that was going to be the case, he might as well make it.
Exactly. So he had an open bar, and he hired some local beauty pageant ladies in bathing suits to entertain his guests. And so everyone was feeling good. And he ended up, not many years later, controlling all of the stock of NASCAR, which remains a family business, even though it has this fancy name that kind of implies there are these governing bodies running it. It's one family's business, and his heirs are billionaires today.
To some extent, the story of NASCAR is the story of some exceptional personalities. Richard Petty, of course, whom we've mentioned. Dale Earnhardt, certainly, to name drivers with whom most people are familiar. They may be less familiar with Tim Richmond, but he may be just as worthy of consideration. Tell us a little bit about him.
Oh, yes. He really broke the mold of what a stock car racer looked like, acted like, how he behaved. He came from a family of a decent amount of privilege, and he just turned the sport on its head, both with his flamboyance and his raw talent. And the dreadful movie Days of Thunder, a lot of people think that the Tom Cruise figure is based on Jeff Gordon, but it's really exactly based on Tim Richmond, who would show up on a Harley with these silk shirts unbuttoned to the midriff and always had a beautiful woman on, actually on each arm, and lived fast, partied hard, you know, did not toe the line of deference to the France family, did not even try to posture himself as a good old boy. And the reason so few fans know he ever lived or existed is because he contracted HIV in an era when that was not acknowledged, certainly among famous people, among athletes. And he died of AIDS-related illness after having been basically kicked out of NASCAR on a trumped-up drug charge. So it was a really sad and tragic story. And for a long time, there was no record of him at a track. He was not really part of their media guide. He was not immortalized as so many fallen champions have been.
Do you think it's fair to say that NASCAR fans regard themselves as more intimately connected to their favorite drivers than fans of, say, baseball or football players connect to their favorites?
Oh, that's just a great question. I think that strikes at the heart of NASCAR's success. None of these fans come to the track to watch the sheet metal or the engines, even though the cars are spectacular. They are coming strictly because of the driver inside. And they don't just know his name. They know his car number, his wife's name, his sponsor's number, his hometown, how many children he has. And largely, he will represent a value, a core value that they identify with. You know, the most powerful and magnetic and polarizing figure in this regard was Dale Earnhardt, the late Dale Earnhardt. And he, you know, short version, came up from very humble means and dropped out of school after eighth grade and just had this desperate quality about his need to escape the dead-end life that was in front of him. And for legions of fans, every race he won was a triumph, not so much for him, but for them. His victories were their victories. Of course, others thought he was just evil incarnate because he was a bully and a thug and would wreck a lot of people on the way to shaking his fist at the world.
You acknowledge in One Hell of a Ride that you were devastated yourself when Dale Earnhardt was killed in a crash 7 years ago. Would you characterize yourself as a fan as well as a reporter?
Oh, boy. You know, I certainly would have never gone to a track if it had not been my job and I was paid. It was an unlikely assignment. I was an unlikely person. And to this day, I don't think I would go, you know, unless it's my job. But in these 16 years that I've been around the sport, I certainly developed enormous regard for the people, for the work ethic, for how much they love the sport. On the point of the day that Earnhardt was killed, I mean, I'm certainly not alone, and I think I speak for so many people when I say that was the worst day of my life.
I'm talking with Liz Clark, author of One Hell of a Ride, How NASCAR Swept the Nation. You're listening to Only a Game. Jeff Gordon is perhaps the best candidate for face of the new NASCAR, or the current NASCAR. He leads all drivers in caps and shirts and bumper stickers sold. But a portion of today's fans, a fairly large portion, hate Jeff Gordon more powerfully than they've ever loved any other driver. When he won at Talladega in 2007, they pelted the track with bottles, which can't have been especially safe. Why the hatred?
You have to realize that in NASCAR, the worst thing a driver can do is not to cheat. I mean, cheating is kind of considered inventive and admirable if you have figured out a way to make your car go fast. That's sort of the essence of ingenuity and cleverness. So the worst thing a driver can do in the culture of NASCAR is to be born with a silver spoon, you know, to not have earned your way, to have glided into the best opportunity without developing the calluses that Dale Earnhardt had. And, you know, the reality is Jeff Gordon worked like a dog for his opportunity. He started racing at age 5, and his family was not wealthy, and they sacrificed a lot. But people never want to hear that he worked for it. He is perceived and has been perceived from day one as a good-looking Californian with blue eyes who is on his second supermodel wife. And then his other crime was toppling Dale Earnhardt from his perch atop the sport. So Jeff was too handsome, too well-spoken, had an air of privilege, and he spoiled the fairy tale ending for the biggest meanie in the sport.
The first NASCAR champion to make over $1 million in winnings was Darrell Waltrip. He won a little more than $3 million in 1985. Last year's champ, Jimmy Johnson, won over $15 million, and who knows how much more on endorsements. How much more can the sport grow?
Oh, I think it's close to topping out, and NASCAR really needs to take a pause this season and look intelligently if they're in the right markets, if they're serving the fans well. There's a lot of sentiment in the Southeast that NASCAR has gotten too fancy, too eager to win Californians into the fan base by changing the start of the races, too excited about racing in Canada and Mexico and giving short shrift to the people who got them here. So they don't need to be thinking about growing the fan base now. They need to be thinking about stabilizing the fan base, I think.
Liz Clark is the author of One Hell of a Ride, How NASCAR Swept the Nation, published by Villard. She joined me from Washington, D.C.'s NPR studios. Liz, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was my privilege.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If we can find a sponsor, we want to take this contest international. Thus spoke Mitsuhiro Hakamada of the Pen Spinning Association of Japan. In this competition, which recently held its first national championship, a pen is spun in the hand, flicked from the little finger to the other fingers, then tossed and bounced off the thumb before being twirled in the palm. Ryuki Omura, a 16-year-old high school student, triumphed over 15 other finalists, impressing the judges with the smooth combination of his tricks, one of which involved flipping the pen from his palm to the back of his hand. Competitors are not required or even encouraged to write anything. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, 3.14159 and more, because it's easy as pie. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Well, you and Fibonacci are making progress there.
Oh, just wait till you hear it. They tell me that there will be some significant men's basketball games played by number one seeds over the next several nights, now that the men's NCAA tournament has come down to precisely the teams that were supposed to make the Final Four,
who comes out on top?
I picked Kansas at the beginning of the year. I picked Kansas in the middle of the year. I picked Kansas when the tournament began. So I'm going to pick
North Carolina.
No. I'm going to stay with the Jayhawks, although I suspect North Carolina is probably the best team in the country.
Memphis coach John Calipari celebrated reaching the Final Four by suspending one of his players. This isn't another attempt to cast his team as underdogs, is it?
No, I think it's an attempt to prove that he has some sort of institutional control. Andre Allen has been suspended for violating unspecified team rules. I suspect all the team rules at Memphis are unspecified, but that's only because I'm a cynic.
Number one seeds Tennessee and Connecticut are in the women's Final Four, but they're joined there by number two seeds LSU and Stanford. Who eventually prevails there?
I think Tennessee will come out of this and winning this thing. However, I think Stanford's going to beat Connecticut. I think Tennessee will beat Stanford for the national championship.
This is the time of year when we begin to hear about coaching changes. Charlie, where do you suppose Indiana University found the guy they just hired to coach the men's basketball team there?
Well, at a small but lovable Jesuit institution on the banks of the Menominee, unfortunately. Tom Crean leaving my alma mater, going to Indiana. No one will work harder than he will. One of the things he did at Marquette was to reattach the program to the great tradition of Al McGuire. So I suspect what Bobby Knight loyalists are left in Bloomington will be pleasantly surprised, because he will reattach that history to this going forward. He runs a relatively clean program. His teams play hard. The problem is he is now dealing with and I say this as a member of a one-time lunatic fan base, he's dealing with an insane fan base right now, and his honeymoon will last until a week into next year's Big Ten season.
In pro basketball, Kevin Garnett and James Posey of the Boston Celtics were shot by the Chicago mascot Benny the Bull during a game on Tuesday. Why hasn't there been more attention paid to this assault?
James Posey felt threatened.
He was shot by Benny the Bull.
Because he doesn't.
Who wouldn't?
He
feel
says
threatened?
They don't like me here already. I mean, what is this nonsense?
He was shot with
what
a T-shirt gun.
What is this nonsense, having idiots in bull costumes shooting clothing at people?
It's the NBA, my friend.
My God, it's like something out of a South Park episode.
On Tuesday, the Celtics became this year's first team to win 60 games. Charlie, is this a particularly significant milestone?
Well, it will be if they win tonight, because it will be the single greatest one-season turnaround in the history of the league, and they still are a signature flagship franchise of the NBA. So, yes, I think they're taking it quite in stride, which is the way to do it. But in terms of everything not involving the 14 guys on the roster, it is a very significant turnaround.
Quite in stride is right. The coach, in fact, when informed of this oncoming achievement, said, "Oh, really? I didn't know that."
Yeah, and I suspect he probably didn't.
Right. The Knicks hired Donnie Walsh on Wednesday to be their new team president. Former team president and current head coach Isaiah Thomas said, quote, "I think we have a very bright future." So how long before Mr. Walsh says, "What do you mean, we?"
The problem is they don't have a very bright head coach. That's the real problem. The only thing Isaiah Thomas should be doing in an NBA arena right now is probably firing T-shirts out of a gun. Unfortunately, there's nothing Donnie Walsh can seem to do about it, because Isaiah Thomas seems to have some sort of compromising photos of James Dolan that allows him to continue to be employed.
My favorite headline of the week was from a Thursday AP story, which goes as follows. Roddick improves career record versus Federer to 2-15. Does this nudge Andy Roddick any closer to a happy retirement?
Well, he's edging closer to that magic 500 mark, which he will never achieve.
13 more.
I think Zeno had something to say about this, doesn't it? I mean, he's going to get halfway closer to Federer and never get there.
Major League Baseball is underway throughout the
league,
of course, and among the teams off to a less than entirely satisfactory start, the New York Mets. Shouldn't somebody have told Pedro Martinez about stretching?
This is unbelievable. He came into the season talking about nothing except what great condition he was in and how ready he was to be the number two starter behind Johan Santana, and everybody picked the Mets to go to the World Series. And he doesn't go five innings before he pulls a hamstring. He's out for a month and a half.
The question Jose Canseco is asking himself this week is, if you've got a new book out, are you hurt or helped when Major League Baseball's investigators show up at your book signing?
Just don't sign anything. Well, I mean, you know, it's brilliant investigating on the part of the MLB gumshoes. Hey, a well-publicized event where the guy we're looking for will be. Let's go find him.
Roger Clemens' former trainer, Brian McNamee, is defraying his legal defense costs by selling memorabilia signed by, wait for it, Roger Clemens. We're not talking about syringes and gauze pads, are we?
No,
here?
Thank the Lord, no. Signed hats, jerseys, photographs, baseballs, anything so he can get about $75,000 for it, which ought to cover maybe a third of his legal expenses.
On Thursday, the Cincinnati Bengals implemented their stringent five strikes and you're out policy. They released wide receiver Chris Henry. Will this move create a frenzy among the teams with stringent six strikes and you're out policies, or will this only serve to ruin our own John Perotti Super Bowl picks? He always picks the Bengals for the next few years.
Well, he's got Chris Henry apparently punched an 18-year-old and broke a car window with a beer bottle, and Mike Brown said his conduct can no longer be tolerated. I stands all I can, and I can't stands no more. Five arrests in 3 years. Enough. Get away from my franchise.
Just to take us out, Charlie, would you like to comment perhaps on the significance of one more number? That would be the number 37.
Yes, Barack Obama, and let's be fair, he did it in seven frames, rolled a 37. And unfortunately, as everything in campaigns these days is on television, he did it on television at a bowling alley in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Now, if he'd gone all 10 frames, he might have been well over 75. We don't know. But all I have to say about this, and I speak from authority here, it's a good thing he already won the Wisconsin damn primary, because something like this finishes you in America's Dairyland.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On last week's program, Charlie Pierce once again expressed his opinion about the prospects of the New York Knicks. This time, Barbara Hansen was listening. She emailed to say, "My long-term boyfriend and I applied for a wedding license this week. However, after listening to Charlie Pierce call Isaiah Thomas Coach Stupid, I said it's all off. I'm marrying Charlie." Last week's program also included a brief story about the members of a rugby team who had subdued an obnoxious drunk on an airplane. According to Brad Sandy, that's not the way it always works out. He wrote, "Your story about the rugby team on the airliner reminds me of the rugby tournament we used to have at the Alaska State Fair each August with teams from Seattle. Sadly, the tournament ended after just 3 years because the Seattle teams were banned successively from each of the only three airlines that flew between Seattle and Anchorage. Apparently, the passengers didn't appreciate good music." In an email headed Mind the Culture Gap, Adu M. Besmer expressed appreciation for our story last week about the opening of the Major League Baseball season in Tokyo. "I was pleasantly surprised to hear the coverage from Tokyo and thought Ken Shulman gave some good insights on the game from the Japanese perspective," the message read. Tracy Moore was not as pleased by the part of my discussion with Tim Kirkchen last week regarding Major League Baseball's diversity game in Memphis. "While I commend Tim Kirkchen for singing the praises of the Mets in terms of diversity," Moore wrote, "he seemed to ignore the other team playing in Memphis that night. The Sox have had an African-American GM and a Hispanic manager. They also had 9 Hispanic players on their opening day roster, and their starting second baseman for the previous 3 seasons was from Japan. The baseball world does extend as far as Chicago. No wonder there are endless accusations of East Coast bias." Jeez, Tokyo on Japan's East Coast? Finally, Walter Booth felt my discussion with Michelle Smith about the women's NCAA basketball tournament could have been more inclusive. "I kept waiting to hear you talk about the potentially biggest game of the madness, that is UConn versus Rutgers, but alas, no mention from you. You could have gotten in a nice dig at Imus, too. What a missed opportunity." Perhaps so. On the other hand, though my beating stick was handy, the horse looked exceedingly dead. You can email us through our newly spiffed up website, onlyagame.org. Our longer email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Each March 14th, math enthusiasts celebrate Pi Day, named for the irrational number which represents the ratio of a circle's diameter to its circumference. This year at Harvard University, computative whiz kids and spectators gathered to see who could recite Pi to the furthest digit. Only a Game's Rachel Paste was there, and she has our report.
Pi, 3.14, and so on and so on. The infinite, transcendental number.
Come to the front if you would like to recite as much of Pi as you can. Volunteers,
Today, five gentlemen are competing to see who can recite Pi out the farthest, which could theoretically take forever if not for the limitations of the human brain. Computers have calculated Pi out over 1 trillion places past the decimal. But humans reciting the number out hundreds, even thousands of places? This is going to be a long day. Today's competitors won't come close to a trillion, but they sure will have fun trying. Harvard University graduate student Ryan Reich attends this event every year.
It's entertaining. I mean, some people think memorizing Pi is stupid, but I don't know. People can do what they want with their own brains, and you don't have to just limit yourselves to some sort of high-minded intellectual pursuit. If you like, feel like rattling off 1,000 digits of Pi, like I expect to hear from somebody, then that's fun to watch.
It's a few minutes past 3, and the Harvard Math Lounge is beginning to fill up. Students, mostly male, are sitting on the sofas lining the somber light gray walls, but they rarely speak to each other, except to comment on each other's t-shirts. Some are solid colors, and many are tie-dyed. Almost all sport complicated algorithms, or at the very least the Pi symbol. John, from Lancaster, Mass., wears a basic blue t-shirt. He's not here for the fashion.
It looks like fun. We can't wait to see how everybody does. I'm not that great with math, so I'm going to just bask in the greatness of all these people memorizing so many numbers and having fun with it.
John's not the only spectator who can't recite the digits of Pi. There's also Scott Commodores.
My complete memorization of Pi stops at 159.
Not bad, actually. And for those who want to learn Pi, but can't stand the idea of rote memorization, Harvard math professor Noam Elkies has the answer, a song.
The steganographic etude or mnemonic etude, unfortunately transcendental etude is taken already.
Professor Elkies, through his music, has memorized 240 digits of Pi, far more than one of today's entrants, Josh Gottlieb, a Harvard PhD candidate in economics. He says he's not a Pi savant, just a normal guy with something to prove.
In high school, my calculus teacher, Mr. Schlanger, rumor had it that he knew 100 digits, and so I had to challenge him. So I learned enough to go head-to-head with him on the last day of class. 3.14159265358979323846264.
Showing up Mr. Schlanger takes only a few minutes, and after reciting 102 places, Josh takes a seat with the rest of the growing audience. Then Cameron Freer takes center stage.
1101 1010 1010 0010 0010.
Tie-dye math t-shirt. Check. Recite Pi in binary. Check. Freer is a Harvard Math PhD candidate, but why the choice of binary?
Well, a few years ago, there were a few entrants in the hexadecimal contest as well as base 10, but not in binary. And so people were just computing it on the fly from hex, but I thought that maybe an entry in base 2, just looking at it directly, might be easier. And so I just found some small initial segment that had reasonable patterns. It seemed to have an unreasonable number of patterns, and so I learned the 50 digits over lunch.
50 digits over lunch. Easy is, well, Pi. Next up, Sean Peasley of Kentucky. He speaks much more quickly than the previous two contestants and is so nervous he actually shakes throughout the recitation.
8481.
Sean is the leader at this point with 481. Up next is Boston College junior James Niles Joyle. He participated last year, but his nerves got the better of him. He played piano to calm himself this time around, and after weeks of study, knows what he has to do.
To recite 3,141 digits of Pi to prove my legitimacy and apparent greatness as a Pi memorist of the world.
And then he shows what he's made of.
3.14159265358979323846262.
A few minutes into James' recitation, the crowd is becoming restless. No one is quite sure how long it takes to recite 3,000 numbers. We may be here forever.
938446. That's 1,000.
The room is silent. There's tension in the air. It's been 20 minutes. Only 2,000 digits to go. After a moment of hesitation, a student on crutches sits down. Following his lead, the 90 or so assembled here do the same as James commences his mathematical journey.
3003558766.
50 minutes, 10 seconds later, James Niles Joyle has the record.
201-497-442. I'm done.
James is clearly thrilled, but not everyone knows how to feel. Some are impressed, like student Jay Potharst.
I didn't expect nearly the level of tension and excitement that I encountered.
But Aaron Silberstein of Harvard and Kartik Vekatram of MIT, both math PhD students, debate the validity of the contest.
Memorizing digits of pi is somehow a parlor trick. And if you want to study pi, then that's a fine thing. Pi is a very interesting number in and of itself. But being able to spout out a random, base 10 digit is not a substitute for understanding of any phenomena that the number pi might be.
The actual acquisition of the digits of pi are pretty much a waste of time, but the skills you build up learning digits of pi are not necessarily useless.
Regardless of what these students think, there is one person in the crowd whose pride cannot be swayed.
I'm really happy for him that he did it. He felt like he wanted to do this, and he did it. I'm really proud of him. I really am.
That's my mom.
For Only a Game, I'm Rachel Paste in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Pi champion James Niles Joyle, who just kept on going.
014-215-03068.
Wow, it's kind of like Pi goes on forever or something. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
3-4-5-4-9-2-0-2-6.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.